Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for the Beyond the Mekong series as broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is the Canadian filmmaker Don Miller, who is the director of Loot, A Story of Crime and Redemption, which premiered at the Cambodian International Film Festival last week. Don, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks, Luke.
It's a fascinating subject and it was a terrific doco. Thoroughly enjoyed it. How did you get involved? And there's obviously two aspects to this. There's the making of the documentary,
right, yeah.
And then there's the looting of the Cambodian artifacts, which we'll get to a bit later.
Great.
I
earn my living doing documentaries, mostly about art, artists. And you know, the longer you're in the art world, the more you wonder about a lot of the things that you see, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to do an art crime film. On October 5th, 2021, I read an article from Malia Pulitzer as part of the Pandora Papers investigation. Douglas Latchford in Bangkok was one of the one of the figures that showed up in all those files that they had. And I just thought, bang, this is it. So interesting. Like, he, what a character.
I think your timing was excellent in that I remember when Tess Davis, the American lawyer, came to me many years ago asking what can be done, how can journalists publish information about Doug Latchford. I'm trying very hard to put this politely, because Latchford was one of those characters that scared the bejesus out of a lot of journalists and a lot of people who were trying to find out what the hell was going on, particularly around Angkor Wat and the looted artifacts. And he was responsible for much of it, but he kind of conveniently died while the production was going. I mean, you had a lot, what I'm getting at is you had a lot more scope to go in depth about Latchford and what
he did. After he passed away. Yeah, I think that's true. And you look at Tess and the people who started really digging into this and were so relentless, right? Around, in particular, that one piece, the Duryodhana, that ended up at the Sotheby's auction house in New York, right? And we were, our timing was fortunate, and I think really being able to get access to, number one, the detective, the American detective who put the indictment together and unraveled the whole story. But then as time went on, I became sort of less interested in Latchford, more interested in these former looters who are now working to bring the material home, right? And so to me, that's where the redemption part comes in.
Sure.
You have these guys who are, by and large, guys who were at gunpoint, effectively, looting this material, right?
They were kids who were drafted into the Khmer Rouge.
Right.
They were caught up in the fighting in the 1990s. They know the local territory. They know where the landmines are. People like Latchford come along and they say, we'll give you a couple hundred dollars if you help us knock this statue off its
pillars. But now these same people, one of them that we feature, Blue Tiger, he was basically kidnapped at 11 by the Khmer Rouge, as you say. You know, he was waiting in line for school. They just grabbed him. And now he's 60 plus, and he's working with the government to bring the stuff back. And so that, to me, is a unique aspect of the Cambodian thing, right? Because there's obviously restitution issues going on all over the world.
And of course, there's the belief structure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, these are gods for people, right? And so you're sitting in the Met Museum or in some billionaire's home having a glass of champagne. Well, that's a nice artifact over there, but you don't realize that's when it's in somebody's fourth home or whatever it is, right? And you don't realize that's in fact a god to people, or that people pray to this or something that's really important.
I'm just thinking back to some of the vision you had of extraordinarily wealthy Americans in New York living that life that other people make movies about, celebrate, kind of, which I find, I think it's all a bit of a nonsense, to be honest.
Well, I do too,
you get in their living rooms, so it's just
full. Well, it's shocking, right?
Yeah.
And $35 million in the case of the Lindemann family was the estimated value of the collection. And, I think that, to me, the most touching part of the film is when you have these Cambodian people saying, you've got somebody, a god with his head cut off above your fireplace. Like, how does that
Yeah.
How do you get satisfaction out of that? I'm a Christian, right? I wouldn't appreciate seeing Jesus Christ with his head lopped off, hanging above someone's fireplace, right?
How difficult was it to get this type of access? I mean, did you have material leaked to you?
We had, I think that Malia Pulitzer is just an excellent investigative journalist, right? Mm-hmm. And so she had files. What I appreciated about her, among other things, was just the diligence. You know, she would sit with a laptop beside her off camera to just make sure she was getting everything right. So she had this encyclopedic knowledge. Then some of the other speakers in the film, and then Brad Gordon, who's a lawyer here, who's a Cambodian-American citizen, put us in touch with Blue Tiger, who was one of the leading looters, right? And we follow, in the film, we track some specific pieces that he looted that ended up in the Met Museum, that ended up with these wealthy collectors in Florida. And then we really had Cambodian teammates working with us, particularly a guy named Makara Uch in this case, who wanted to find these villagers who had actually yanked the things out. And so he set up some of it in advance, some of the interviews in advance, and some of it, they just went to a small village and found people. Mm-hmm. I didn't go because I thought, here's a white Canadian showing up.
It can scare people off.
Scare people off, exactly.
Some kind of official that they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, right, and that there's a legal problem going on here. But they found these people. And, I think the one thing about Latra that's most interesting to me is, we basically published stolen material in a coffee table book.
Yeah.
And that becomes then evidence that you can show to these looters and say, okay, what about this piece, as we do in the film? And, I dug that up 10 feet away.
Right.
And so that's interesting. But I think the research that the Cambodian team did of finding these people who had actually dragged the things out, and they were, as you say, they were paid pennies on the dollar for pieces that are then sold for $1 million.
We're actually talking about Doug Latchford, who was a British colonial child, wound up in Bangkok, where he had notorious personal habits, I suppose is one way of putting it.
Yeah.
He was the head of the Thai Bodybuilding Association, and he was blamed for looting many of the artifacts. In fact, a couple of the stories that I have heard, which weren't in your doco, it'd be difficult to prove, I guess, but was how they rented tanks.
Yeah.
They cross the border, rent a tank, drive it into Angkor Wat, mow down, push down anything they want, pick it up, throw it in the back and carry it out.
Yeah, and so whether it's tanks or some other means, like a lot of these sculptures were built inside the temples.
Mm-hmm.
So just getting them out was impossible, right? Because they weren't taken in through the front door. They were built inside after the front door was there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I think really gets people emotionally is that the heads were cut off, the sculptures were cut into pieces, shipped off to London, where they're then all glued back together and put in good shape, right?
Yeah. Latchford did emerge as the main character in terms of who was responsible for this looting.
Yeah.
I've also known other art dealers in Hong Kong,
honest
people who do the right thing, and they all knew of Latchford going back 20, 30
years.
I knew he was
crooked.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
But difficult to prove.
Well, that's right. And so that's, what was interesting to me was the relentlessness of some of these American investigators. And it could really, on one hand, it could have been anyone else. But on the other hand, so much of the art world and the big dollar part of the art world revolves around Manhattan, right? And I think, you mentioned Tess Davis from the Antiquities Coalition, just won't give up, right?
Yeah, she's quite dogmatic.
Yeah, just dig in and won't give up. And so one of the things that's interesting about this story to me is you see a few individuals like Tess, like some of the people here in Cambodia, like J.P. Labatt, who's in the film quite extensively, who's from Homeland Security in New York, won't give up, and you can actually get the result, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically what happened is Latchford was indicted, and then a few months later he passed away. His main co-conspirator passed away 6 months after that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what you have now is, again, back to the redemption part of the story, is the Cambodian government just running this sort of multi-pronged campaign. And one thing that I think is really interesting that they do is they go to the media, right, and they try to stir up all kinds of trouble as they go along, as opposed to, government to government, and it's a low priority and it gets lost.
Well, it's been an interesting time on that front, because the Cambodian government isn't always known for its accessibility to journalists, the media, and the wider world at large. But as I think when I first met Tess many years ago, it was, here is an issue that the Americans and the Cambodians can put everything else aside and just focus on this issue, which is of mutual interest.
Yeah, and I think that is what happened, right? And I think a lot of these pieces, obviously, are in the UK. Mm-hmm. They're in museums in France and so on. But for whatever reason, it is the Americans who seem to be the ones who are most ambitious and most successful about getting the stuff returned.
Right, and of course, this is having ramifications around the world. Other art galleries are...
They won't touch the stuff, right? Yeah, they won't. They're like never heard of Cambodia, heard of a Khmer antiquity, Angkor Wat. What's that, right? And so, it's a, as Malia says in the film, you know, it's like huge amounts of money crossing international borders, really just a basically unregulated market, right?
Well, it would be an easy opportunity to launder money as well.
Well, yeah, I think there's tons of money laundering associated with this more broadly.
Also in regards to, this is not a problem that Cambodia has a monopoly on. I mean,
no,
it's an issue that goes right around the world. Have you had any feedback on where else this could lead?
Well, I mean, I think what's interesting, you know, you have the Benin bronzes in mostly in European galleries and European homes, right? So that's, I think, kind of the leading issue. I was talking to an Australian visitor here at the film festival, and I'm talking about how this relates to Aboriginal art that would have been taken out of Australia on one hand, but yet then on the other hand, they're the home of Wadawalooded art from the developing world themselves, right? And I think in terms of things that follow out of this is the National Gallery of Australia, I think, is a leader in returning stuff to Cambodia. All these museums, including the Met, are now, you know, installing people to deal with the provenance. But there's a real disconnect, right, between, okay, who owns this? Like, who owns this stuff? And if it's in a collection and it's stolen property, well, you don't really own it, right?
Well, this goes back to, there were a few terms in the film which were kind of new to me. I'm not an art expert, but the concept of provenance.
Yeah, so that's basically tracking, you know, from as far as you can go back in history as to who owned it. And what we found out in the course of doing the film is a lot of it's just bogus.
And this goes back to the books that Latchford produced, which, as you were saying earlier, was his own undoing.
Right, it was his own undoing. And again, you know, just the arrogance, I guess, right, and kind of living in a different era that you would publish a coffee table book of looted art, right, and then it would say, you know, the source or the ownership in the book is, you know, listed as Scanda Trust. Well, he owns Scanda Trust, right, and this is one of the things that came out in the Pandora Papers, right, is, you know, just this covering up of the stuff, but in the most minimal kind of sloppy fashion, just like, okay, what can we type up here to slide by basically border authorities around the world? What cover can we give the museums? And I think one of the things that's interesting about this story, and I think for the others too, is that the museums, so the provenance, okay, that's helpful, but they're as interested, I think, some of them, in having something they can show to the press and say, oh no, we did our homework, look at this, than actually finding out where the piece came from, under what circumstances, and so on.
Were there any major issues arising when you were filming? As I mentioned earlier, Doug Latchford had a long history of threatening people, and they were particularly local journalists.
It was interesting. It was interesting in Bangkok. We started out with a list of like 20 names. All these people, they had never heard of the guy, right? Except there's documentary evidence, photographs, etc., that they had, right? So getting access to people. So we got a few people, very limited number of people in Bangkok who were willing to talk. Journalist who's, I think, a friend of yours, Alan Parkhouse, was very good source for us in terms of just laying out the information, and particularly, you know, the crazy...
Sure, Alan's worked out of Bangkok for like the last 30 years, and he knows...
He knew his stuff, and he could help us, not only in terms of being on camera, but help us just kind of organize our thoughts and how... you know, what was the structure, what was Latchford's role in Bangkok? You do that in the film as well, right? Yeah. And then what was, you know, what was the outcome of this, and in particular the bodybuilder fascination, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it was, it's hard to know where to start with that sort of thing. And so someone else mentioned that if you have a security team, if you're serious and you need security around you, you don't employ bodybuilders. They look great.
Yeah, right.
And they're in their speedos. and they've got big muscles and things like that, but they are not what you hire for a security team, which was his excuse for the...
for him to drag them around. Well, I think, I mean, he seemed to just go with this entourage that included some of them and some rich collectors and some museum curators, pretty much, you know, just... go through Cambodia, and the term that the people use, Tess and other people use, is this sort of looting to order, right? Here's a photograph, look at this. Right. I talked to a guy from India who isn't in the film, you know, and he had art dealers from the UK submitting, you know, trips where they're basically finding material to loot and submitting it on their expense form, like, you know, like it's a legitimate transaction going on here.
Yeah, I won't mention any names because they are probably still alive. Yeah, still out there. But I have known of diplomats in particular countries that have smuggled loot, artifacts, antiquities out of the country in diplomatic pouches.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And that's some of those diplomatic pouches could be quite big.
And heavy. I had to guess.
Yeah, you're carrying 20 kilos of stone in your suitcase.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's kind of extraordinary. You had a film crew consisting mainly of Khmers?
Yeah, so we filmed here once at a conference with a Khmer film crew, and then came back really for an extensive tour. We had a Khmer team, Makara Uch and Panita Kao being the main leaders of it, and a Chinese-Canadian guy who joined us from Vancouver. And they went to these villages, and then we had another team that was in Bangkok trying to unravel that and trying to get out of Dodge, you know, safely, right, was my main concern, that we weren't crossing too many people that would track us down. And then we spent about 11 days going through the temples with a combination of Canadian people, mostly Khmer, mostly Cambodian. And a great film industry here and great spirit, you know, like people who felt really strongly about this story, obviously, and were passionate about their work, not only as professionals, but as people who were doing their part to bring the gods home, as the phrase goes.
Was it difficult to raise funding?
It was private funding, principally, and, you know, we still need to recoup a lot of it, so...
That's my next question, actually, is the state of
we have a couple of industry. Well, I mean, the state of the documentary world is in flux, like I think anything to do with communication, right? So we're in negotiations and talks with a couple of really great distributors, and what we want to do, I really wanted to get the film shown at this particular festival just for my own satisfaction and for you know, to salute our
Cambodia.
Team here. It's
a
Cambodian film and a lot of Cambodian people working on it, and so I really wanted to do that. But now, you know, within the next month or 6 weeks, we've got to make some decisions about that.
Right. In terms of where the investigations are going now,
Well, I mean, the Met Museum, you know, is kind of exhibit A of this questionable behavior, in my opinion, and that was probably the biggest surprise to me, right, was... you know, and a lot of the materials in the film, but was that they were just not good actors in this whole case. So, I mean, my understanding is that they have other material that hopefully will be finding its way back over here. The Cambodians, they returned 14 pieces, which we have in the film, and that's great. But, I mean, there's just a real disconnect, I think, between the Met thinking we own it and the Cambodians thinking, well, no, you don't, right? Mm-hmm. So there's more material there. There's obviously museums all over Europe. And then there's, you know, these private collectors, which are really difficult, difficult, right? I mean, you know, the source for the American collectors was spread in Architectural Digest magazine, right? And if that had never happened, if they hadn't, for whatever reason, wanted to show off, look at me, my living room in Florida, then the material would probably still be there, right? So the private collections are the toughest. And then Douglas Letchford's daughter inherited his collection and, you know, has a legal agreement with the government of Cambodia to return, I think, all of it. I think all of it. And so that's in process. I wouldn't say it's like moving with great speed, but it is happening. Mm-hmm.
It's this doubling down that I've noticed as a an aging journalist.
And I'm an aging filmmaker, so here we are.
Yeah, anyway. Over the last 20, 30 years, there was a time when you could, I think, deal with corporates, the wealthy, governments. The world 20, 30 years ago seemed a lot more sensible.
Yeah, right.
And now, these days, it's like the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. You did this. We shouldn't need litigation or lawyers or investigators.
Yeah, well,
it's just absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah.
But there's this attitude of, not us, a lot of children with their hands
in the cookie jar. And, you know, as Brad Gordon, the attorney for the government here, says, I just have to have something that no one else has. Well, okay, good for you. But there's plenty of ways to do that.
Yeah.
You can go buy a Lamborghini if that's what you like, right? There's one guy who we didn't include in the film just for time reasons, James Clark, but he's a founder of Netscape and was paid billions of dollars when he sold the company. And he collected a lot of this stuff, and he got called from Homeland Security in New York and returned it.
Okay.
You know, without, you know, it's expensive to get it over here and that sort of thing, but he didn't push back, right?
Well,
you would think, A, that you shouldn't need a law enforcement officer calling you, but B, when they do, like, how's it going to end? Like, one way or another, you're going to be giving this stuff back, right?
Well, one thing I was curious about is the costs associated with this. The reaction, do they turn around and say, look, we spent $2 million on this. We're more than happy to give it back, but we'd like our $2 million back too. Or is it treated as stolen property?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of the Khmer stuff, it is treated as stolen property.
Right.
I think there are probably other cases where people, you know, I have a friend who's a wealthy collector, and he said, oh, these people, you know, think of the tax benefits. Think of the tax benefits of returning it. And there's no evidence of anybody that we have in the film that was the case, right?
Yeah.
But in this world, that was, you know, at least some good's going to come out of this, right?
I do have a small part in this doc, a couple of minutes.
Do.
I think I was interviewed for 4 hours or something. You got 2 minutes, but
that was
important.
It's quality, not quantity.
Indeed. I remember you asking me about the history of looting, and I think I mentioned that the Brits were famous for it. The colonialists would come in and they would pretend, we're going to do you a favor because you obviously can't look after this. You obviously don't care about it.
Yeah.
We'll
handle it for you.
Yeah, and then it becomes this enormous excuse.
Total excuse. And I mean, Latchford said, if we didn't take care of it, it would have been used for target practice by the Khmer Rouge. Well, the Khmer Rouge did a lot worse than shooting at a statue, obviously.
Indeed, they did, yeah.
But there's no evidence that that's the case, right? Mm. And we have a guy in the film, Will Corner, from the Cultural Heritage at Risk database, British guy. You know, and his analogy is, I have a bicycle that I leave out in the rain, and you have a bicycle that you keep at home and take care of it so your bike's in better condition. Well, that doesn't mean you should own my bicycle. Like, you know, this whole argument to me is really bogus, that somehow, like, if it belongs to Cambodia, then it's not up to the British people or anywhere else in the world to decide that, well, we'll keep it for you just out of our good nature. That is not a logical thing.
The odd thing about Latchford, which I found a little harder to kind of comprehend him as a character, was that it's easy to put him into this sort of post-colonial bubble or the kind of, you know, he was... where was he born again? He was...
I was born in India.
Raised in...
India and then in Britain. Yeah.
And I know other people who are a little bit similar to him, but even then he seems like 40 years out of date. These are the sorts of characters we'd meet in the 1980s.
Yeah, that's right.
And 1990s.
He, for whatever reason, he was out of date, out of fashion. And I think, what a character, right? I mean, you know, so some of this looting did go on. in the 80s and 90s. You hear stories of him actually doing looting in Thailand when he was living there, right? You know, what's amazing is people knew it but turned a blind eye, right, for all these years. And then he came up here and managed to ingratiate himself and be, you know, like the term he uses is this adventurer scholar, which you can just close your eyes and imagine what's an adventurer scholar is going, you know, yeah, through the bush bravely.
Well, you know, there was that marvelous line in Loot where he wrote a letter, or he wrote in one of the books that he was Khmer in a former life,
yeah,
and
true.
That he was entitled to these.
Well, that somehow that, yeah, that he felt he. Now, what did he believe that? That is basically what he said, right? But did he believe it, or was that an excuse, or
to make $5 or $10 quick million dollars?
Yeah, make a quick $1 million because I, you know, my last life, I was, you know, taking care of these statues, right? But I mean, that was one of the things he asserted, is it, in a previous life. Mm. And so he either was entitled to the stuff, or this is why he was so obsessed with it, or whatever. But he said it repeatedly.
And it goes to what an obnoxious kind of character he was, in the sense that Cambodians do believe in reincarnation. They are Buddhist.
Yeah.
These types of statues, in particular the relationship with the kings at Angkor Wat,
of course,
the deities right now. I mean, it does sort of like show his complete contempt.
What's
that? Sorry, complete contempt. But
I think contempt's a good word, and you know, he's a bizarre guy. I mean, that's part of the reason we did the film. Yeah, honestly, about him as opposed to someone who's more conventional.
That was another point I wanted to grab you on, was that how difficult was it to decide what to leave in and what to leave out? And I say that because you've got a lot of characters in this movie, and it's structured in that kind of way, which is quite prominent now, where let the interviews
have a narrator, and I think you know, it's like a glass of water, right? Like everybody's seen films that are too long, like half the films you see you leave thinking, oh, that's too long, right? So we really were determined not to do that, and one thing that filled up the glass of water was we really wanted to have these villagers speak, right? Because I just think that's the most emotionally touching part, and for them to have a voice in, you know, this is what I did, putting this in an ox cart and dragging it over here and so on, and now, as I say, working to try to get it back. So that actually limited us in terms of the other characters that we could use, right? Because we wanted them not just there as kind of ornaments in the film, but as people who are telling the story, right? I mean, I think the thing to me is the Met Museum, and you know, just as not as a freestanding item, but just as you would think they would be more concerned about where this stuff came from, and you would think that they would behave more in a forthcoming, honest way.
I think it's a touchstone. I mean, and it's not just the Met. You're looking at the auction houses, like Sotheby's, and these were all, if you go back 20 years ago, these names were considered above
reproach.
Exactly. Yeah.
But there isn't much left in the world that's above reproach. I mean, when you talk about the generational change that you would have seen here, this is just another example of an institution that you would think would be above reproach. And
they're just disappointing, like...
oh, here's another one, right? Yeah. And again and again and again, right? But so that, to me, was probably the most interesting part, and to get this detective, J.P. Labatt, on camera, just talking about how difficult they were to deal with, how the provenance records were just not properly organized, right?
What's next?
Well, next for us is to get this thing out to the world and get paid back and have, you know, and spread this story around the world. I think what's interesting here, and a number of people in this festival were saying, oh, you need to do a follow-up in a few years. I'd rather have Cambodian, you know, our Cambodian team go do the follow-up. But I think that what's next is more material coming back here. I think what's next is building a new museum here, as far as I can tell. And then in terms of what's next for me is probably catching my breath. But I really got the bug in terms of this particular issue and this particular part of the world. I'm fascinated.
Okay, so you're looking at Southeast Asia.
Oh, yeah, and looking at doing, you know, probably more work with other countries around here, and less focused necessarily on the Americans. I mean, we just kind of were led there because the events that were unfolding were...
it can't be ignored.
Couldn't be ignored over there, but there are, you know, like the Europeans and even wealthy people probably right here.
Well, one does wonder, given the state of Cambodia over a 30-year civil war and what happened here in terms of the looting, one has to wonder what's going on in countries like Myanmar.
Syria was in, and the Antiquities Coalition, you know, is very active in terms of this, right? But if you look at just pictures of Syria, right, and just the pieces that were, you know, just basically, again, and, you know, it's hard to describe the scale. We tried to in the film, but I think it's similar in Syria, where you just have, like, the vast majority of these temples and these religious sites being raided, right? Yeah. Like, not a few of them over here, but, like, the vast majority. One thing that's interesting, and I referenced the Heritage at Risk database, you know, they went into Ukraine and cataloged as the war was starting.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are records about the specific pieces that are being, probably as we speak, looted out of Ukraine, but there's a database that says, okay, so if this piece shows up at auction in, you know, some country anywhere in the world, well, there's a database that now you go to and say, okay, well, hang on, this piece, how the hell did that come out of Ukraine? Because of these forged provenances, they would say, oh, it was collected from Ukraine 20 years ago, and it's been with a private collector in Switzerland, hypothetically speaking, right? Well, it's nonsense. It was taken out in the middle of the war, right? And so that's where I think this story goes, is kind of proactively dealing with Myanmar. I can't imagine what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, Mars is an extraordinary country, and given the earthquake that happened last week, the whole country is just flattened. But people are wondering what has happened in Bagan, which is similar in status to, say, Angkor Wat.
Okay,
and
all
this—it's just tumbling down, and people
I've
will
seen
go
the video
in
of the will, of the temples just like
it's
falling over.
It's a harsh thing. So I guess at the end of the day, you could be well-employed
for better or for worse. I could be doing this for another 30 years.
On that note, Don Miller, director
of
Loot, A Story of Crime and Redemption.
Thanks a lot, Luke.
Thanks very much.